The Athletic.
Instead of taking up that gym membership that you wouldn't use even if the gyms were open, how's about subscribing to The Athletic for just £4 a month as a New Year's resolution? You'll get unrivaled football coverage with analysis and in-depth features from the very best writers around, exclusive Q&As with Athletic staff, and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts, including this one. Find out more and sign up today at theathletic.com/totally.
Totally Football Show. Today, a big win for Man City at the Etihad and one at Anfield too, as Liverpool's home form and Man United's away record combine for a goalless draw. We draw our conclusions and then talk Brighton's win at Elland Road. Could Leeds be tired? Hail West Brom's derby triumph and salute Spurs' win over the Blades with that quite astonishing effort from Ndombele, who didn't get substituted once. All that, plus we hear about Inter, Juventus and Chinny Reckon, telltales of Jimmy Hill. It's all in the Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello, listener, and thank you so much for joining us here on Totally for all your Monday football roundup needs. It's the 18th of January, and standing by to do football talking for you, we've got Daniel Storey. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, James.
Michael Cox is along as well. Hello, Michael.
Hello, James.
Joining us from the civilised world, it's Dion Fanning.
Hi, James.
Lovely to have you back, Dion.
Great to be back.
We're midway through the season, you know, midway. What conclusion can you draw for us, Dion, midway through the season?
I think we're reaching a point where perhaps Liverpool and Manchester United supporters are thinking that they both want their least worst option at this stage is Manchester City to win the league.
Ah, well, they might just get their wish at that point, based on what we saw on Sunday the 17th of January. We'll touch on Man City's win and the draw at Anfield shortly. Daniel and Michael, do you have a conclusion to mark this midway point of the season?
Yeah, my conclusion is that now we've hit the midway point, I no longer have a problem with Daniel saying that teams are on course to do things. Because sometimes he says, you know, Burnley are on course to score two goals all season, three games in, and I find it really irritating. So I won't take exception to that anymore, Daniel.
That's good to know. I mean, it probably doesn't rank even the top 10 of irritating things I do, but it's...
Do you have something that you'd now like to allow Michael to do, like not give Ole Gunnar Solskjaer credit for being a good manager?
I feel that would be sort of grabbing a huge rock and throwing it around my very small greenhouse.
All right, okay.
No, I do think that... kind of linking this slightly to the Liverpool-Man United game, I do think that there's a sense this season that in big games, we're probably going to have to get used to the fact that teams are very happy to take a point with three or four games to come in the next 14, 15 days, and that we might well see more of this. You know, teams just happy to sacrifice. I think the league might well be won against the rest rather than against the big six.
All right, well, let's get a quick check on the scores then. After what was mostly round 19 of the season, West Brom on Saturday won the Black Country Derby 3-2. West Ham were also winners, 1-0 over Burnley. That's their third straight 1-0 win, the Hammers. Chelsea beat Fulham, well, Leicester beat Saints, and Brighton won at Leeds, who haven't scored a goal or even taken a point since they and everyone had a go at Karen Carney. Sunday, Spurs held on to a lead, winning 3-1 at Sheffield United with a worldie from Ndombele. There were no leads whatsoever in the goalless draw at Anfield, and Man City beat Palace 4-0 in fairly spectacular fashion. It means that the top four are now just 3 points apart. Man United top, 2 points ahead of Man City and Leicester City, Manchester City with a game in hand, with Liverpool fourth now, just a point further back and just a point ahead of Spurs. At the other end, Brighton move up, Burnley drop into the danger seat just above the bottom three, where West Brom are now 5 points from safety. David Weston writes in to say, just a plea not to spend 20 minutes of the pod talking about a game that merits no time whatsoever. It was a match entirely without talking points. Whichever does he mean? And surely it had some. We'll come on to, I think, the fixture in question very, very shortly. But let's begin with hot streaks. Man City, 4-0, their victory over Palace. That's their fifth straight win. It's their seventh clean sheet in their last nine, and pretty much all the goals were pretty wonderful.
Yeah, they were, and they're also sharing out those goals. Ilkay Gundogan's got four in his last six, which seems strange. He's playing slightly further up the pitch. John Stones obviously scored twice, which is highly unusual, but probably a sign that his confidence is up. Kevin De Bruyne hobbled off with looked like a bit of a sore ankle, but other than that, it was so, so routine. Palace didn't have a shot on target, and it does feel all of a sudden like Manchester City are playing opponents who come to the game almost as they did in 17, 18 and 18, 19, where they kind of, you know, they're happy to take a 2-0 and move on to a game they think they can take something out of, which is worrying, I'd say, for the rest of the Premier League, because I think they're probably the only team that opponents play and feel like that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting the way City have come with this run of form, and I think a lot of the kind of narratives around City this season were formed prematurely at the start. I think informed too by the sense that Pep couldn't keep going. You know, that there is a sort of a natural shelf life to Pep Guardiola as a manager, and you know, the early defeats to Leicester, and then, you know, later on to Spurs, they gave this sense that, you know, City weren't going to be a realistic challenger. But clearly, like the run of form they're on, as Daniel says, like the way the goals are being spread out, the solidity they also have in the team, the form of Stones as well in defence, and, you know, now scoring goals as well, I think they are their favourites for the title now. And when you look around, when you look at the teams around them, I think it's right that they're favourites.
Well, they're the team on the hot streak. But I guess one of the lessons of the mistakes we made in judging them early is that it might be a mistake to judge anybody based on any run of results at the moment. Michael, they are in tremendous form. What could stop them? What could derail them? KDB's ankle?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, it's interesting what Daniel says about the goals being shared around, which is completely true in terms of who's scoring them. I mean, no one scored more than five, which is what Sterling has managed. But in terms of assists, I mean, De Bruyne's managed 10 assists so far. No one else has managed more than three, again, is Sterling. So yeah, I think they are very dependent on him, and taking him out of the equation, I think you've got a much less competent side. So yeah, that's the main thing I would say. But otherwise, I think it's been a great month for them. Obviously, five straight wins in the Premier League, also a progression in the League Cup, getting through to the final, and in the FA Cup as well. So yes, they look so much stronger than midway through December, where they really hadn't started playing really this season.
I think the other thing maybe I certainly slightly overlooked is the fact that we had a very short pre-season, and they lost Leroy Sané, who admittedly didn't play a huge amount last season. They also lost David Silva, and Sergio Aguero has not really played much this season. So they're three players who last season, if all had been fit and happy at the club, would have started every big game, I think. And maybe that took a bit more time than we thought to get over. And Guardiola clearly thought that the way to do that was to make them more resilient than they have. I think it's a little bit generous to say he's masterminded that, because I don't think anyone, even he, saw John Stones coming and stepping up quite as impressively as he has. He was seen as maybe an alternative to Diaz rather than a partner. Laporte would have been the natural one to start every game. But it's working.
In the meantime, with City looking well-placed, let's move on to the earlier game at Anfield. No goals, but do we at least get to draw some conclusions from Liverpool 0, Man United 0?
I think we can draw some conclusions. I think there has to be, you know, the old line that the definition of insanity is doing the same thing and expecting different results. Maybe now we know to stop talking up Liverpool-Manchester United games, because it's a long time since you can really look back on an epic, thrilling match. And I think there was a little bit of caution from both managers. I think Solskjaer might be thinking that he was cautious in how Manchester United approached it. I thought that the team selection from Klopp was a bit cautious in terms of playing Henderson at the back with Fabinho, and I think he could have maybe risked one Reece Williams or one of the young players at the back. And because when you look at how United approached the game in the first half, It was comfortable for Liverpool at the back. Fabinho was the outstanding player of the game, I thought. And what you lose in not having Henderson in midfield, I think, was something that actually Liverpool, it was something they were lacking, especially after the first 25 half minutes or half an hour.
Mm. Let's have a quick dip in the post bag. Speaking of definition of insanity, repeating the same thing again and again, Alessio Di Maria reminding us that Liverpool Man United will be taking place next weekend as well when they face each other in the FA Cup. John Sands asked, did any of the pods still remember that Shaqiri was at Liverpool?
Yeah, he's apparently been, Klopp says he's looked really good in training. He's had a fairly disastrous run of injuries in that none of them have been hugely serious, but they've been enough to pepper his time at Liverpool and therefore pepper him getting into a very settled team. The one thing about the defensive headaches is that it does create room in midfield for a player like Shaqiri. And I thought he was pretty good first half. I thought he protected the ball well, worked quite well with Thiago and Trent Alexander-Arnold down the right-hand side. It was just that final ball was poor. I thought Roberto... lost a bit of faith with Roberto Firmino. I know he's not a natural finisher and a natural elite-level goal scorer, but he seems to have lost the creativity as well at the moment. And he has to start because Divock Origi is seemingly the next cab off the rank, and I think there's a huge drop-off to go there. But yeah, that was... I feel like if Firmino's not quite on it, then the other two next to him suffer.
Did you also remember that Van der Beek was at Man United, Daniel?
Yeah, that's the mad one for me because he's played 251 minutes in the Premier League this season. Now, it can take players to acclimatise, but it's a lot easier to acclimatise when you're getting some football. And I thought Bruno was Manchester United's worst player. He completed 7 passes in the first half. He didn't really do much more in the second half. He had that free kick, but you know, he's always produced some set pieces. But in open play, I don't think he really did anything. And more broadly, I do think Solskjaer should or will regret not going more attacking, if not in team selection, then at least in style. He seems to have got this thing now against, maybe caused by the Spurs defeat, the 6-1 defeat to Spurs, but they haven't scored, I think, in the last 4 games against big 6 teams now. And maybe he thinks they can win the league by doing kind of what I hinted at in the intro, which is beating everyone else.
Well, they are currently top of the pile. Sorry, Dion.
No, I was just going to say that I think what Daniel says about Firmino, it also underlines how big a loss Jota is, because not only was he, you know, scoring so many goals, he did actually seem to focus Firmino's mind a lot more at the start of the season. And I think when his form was dropping off, Liverpool could bring Jota in, but also Firmino was the way he's dropped off now. As Daniel said, there's really not the lack of cohesion among the front three at Liverpool was kind of startling, because so much is built on that, and when that isn't happening the way it is at the moment, it's a big problem for them.
So Duncan Alexander pointing out that Liverpool are actually being outscored this year by Andy Carroll. So what's behind that? Why has the kind of instinctive relationship between the front three dropped off so badly? Why don't Liverpool score anymore?
I think maybe there's an element of fatigue. I mean, that front three has played pretty consistently over the last 2 or 3 years without much break, without too much rotation. I must say, I don't necessarily agree with the criticism of either manager, actually, in terms of their level of ambition. I mean, I thought after Klopp decided that he was going to go with 2 midfielders in his defence, I think most managers after that would have chosen a very cagey central midfield 3, maybe Milner, maybe Oxlade-Chamberlain. I thought the decision to play Shaqiri in a right-sided, right of a 3 midfield role was very attacking. And as Daniel says, I thought he was probably the best player in the first 20 minutes. I mean, from Solskjaer's perspective, I thought United dominated the last 20 minutes. I think they had 2 really good chances with the Shaw pullback for Fernandes and also the Pogba chance. I think if you'd said to Solskjaer going to the last 20 minutes, they're going to be your chances and Liverpool won't have any real chances, he would have taken that, and rightly so. And I think really the problem was poor decision-making from both sides. I thought Firmino, as Daniel mentions, is not playing well. When he didn't slip in Robertson after about 15 minutes or something, that was a terrible decision. And later in the game, are we allowed to say anything bad about Marcus Rashford? I thought he completely wasted that chance when Fabinho made up the ground on him. That was what Manchester United are all about. I mean, they were playing for that type of opportunity. So I thought this was I didn't think it was as bad as a lot of people are saying, to be honest. I thought it was an all right game, but it was let down by poor decision making from the key attacking players.
Mm. All right. You didn't feel that Solskjaer, given the way those final opportunities came in the last 10 minutes or so, that maybe United should have just gone for it a bit earlier?
Not really. No, I mean, Manchester United play at their best when they're playing counter-attacking football. I don't really understand what people want from them in those kind of situations. I mean, yeah, I thought United actually looked at their best in patches in the opening half when they did have space to break into. There was a Fred ball in behind that just about escaped Rashford, I think. I mean, it's situations like that I think they have to make more of. But yeah, I thought they had the best chances in the last 20 minutes. And if you played those chances again, I don't know the XG, but if you played those chances again, the Fernandes one from the pullback and the Pogba chance, I think they'd probably score, weren't they? And then we're all saying, what a great job Solskjaer got his tactics right. I can't really see that much criticism for either manager after this game.
Were they that huge, those chances? The one to Fernandes basically sort of bounced off him. He didn't get much time, I think, to prepare. Is that fair?
Yeah, he needed to lift that chance. It felt like he poked at it rather than kind of lifting it. If he'd have lifted it above knee height, he would have scored, I think.
Right.
The Pogba one was... Yeah,
the
I mean...
The Pogba chance was good. That's a good chance.
Right, and a fine save from Alisson. A defender closing in, I think, maybe forced his hand a bit in terms of where he placed it. But, you know, that's what he's there to do. Fair enough. All right, well, so some good points from the game. Some nice flashes from Thiago once again. Luke Shaw with an excellent performance against Salah. I didn't expect that one to go quite as heavily in the United left-back's favour.
Dion rightly talked earlier about the Jota effect on Firmino, and I think exactly the same with Alex Tellers and Luke Shaw, because since he signed, it does look to have, subconsciously or otherwise, given Shaw a bit of a nudge in the right direction, which, this is a guy who should be thinking about playing for a starting place at the Euros this summer. England have got a huge collection of right-backs, but not so many left-backs. And, he looks on it. I think he dealt with Salah pretty easily. I'd probably, without wanting to be too negative, I'd probably say that was more Salah's not really getting involved in the game enough than Shaw. But it was more when he attacked. You know, the pullback for Fernandes was great. The good thing is that the worry with Shaw sometimes is his stamina going late on in games, but he was still overlapping after 80, 85 minutes, which is great.
I give some credit to Lindelof as well, who never really seems to get any praise. And I think a lot of people were surprised he started instead of Eric Bailly. I mean, he's a funny player, Lindelof. I think it's pretty difficult to say anything he really excels at. And I think people struggle to almost place him what type of centre-back he is. But sometimes he goes through games like that. He never puts a foot wrong. I think he reads the game really well. His positional sense is very good. He's good on the ball without being a real kind of, you know, diagonal ball merchant. But he never really seems to get any praise when he plays well. So here's some praise.
Why is that, do you think? Wrong kind of haircut, wrong kind of name? And often it's something as simple as that.
Maybe. I mean, he wasn't a glamour name when he came. He's a solid player. He's quite understated, I think. He's not a kind of tub-thumping leader, is he? Which, I mean, compared to someone like Ruben Dias, who I think has been very good, but I think people like the fact he's a proper defender and celebrates when he clears the ball and stuff. Lindelof is a bit more low-key, but yeah, I thought that was a good decision by Solskjaer to play him. I think in these big games, he's actually generally pretty solid.
Excellent. Dion, you were on Second Captains recently talking about why United won't win the league. Has this result at all affected your thinking on the title race?
No, because Manchester City are going to win the league.
Oh, yeah,
so I don't need to say I was wrong. Because Manchester City's run of form has meant that Manchester United won't win the league. I still think, some of the issues with United, not so much the issues, but I think you saw today probably why their position at the top of the table is a bit of a false position. Because, you know, I know what Michael's saying about if those chances had gone in, United would have won the game. But at the same time, if Liverpool's front three was functioning properly in the first half, United sat so deep, they were there for the taking if Liverpool were functioning properly. And with Bruno Fernandes not playing well, with Pogba kind of sort of really doing nothing wide on the right, you saw why United probably are still a way away from a genuine title challenge.
Well, we're approaching David Weston's 20-minute limit, so let's just wrap that bit up. Just to mention that, as previously cited, they will be going up against each other next weekend in the FA Cup, fourth round. Before that, United are at Fulham, who lost 1-0 to Chelsea this weekend, and Liverpool take on Burnley, who themselves had a 1-0 defeat at the hands of West Ham, with Mikel Antonio making his return to league action and immediately getting on the score sheet. The other game from Sunday, just to finish off this chunk of chat, saw Spurs go to Bramall Lane and get their first victory there since December 1975. What was number one back then, Michael?
Big
Christmas number one, 1975. Was number one for about 3 months. Bohemian Rhapsody by the Queen. Not the Queen, but, you know, by Queen then. And Ndombele, that goal. I mean, some people in the TV studio were saying, did he mean it? He was trying to hook it back, keep it in play. Daniel, you're not having any of that, are you?
Well, no, he aimed exactly what he did, and he was the only player in the penalty area. And secondly, because he looked at where Ramsdale was about half a second before he did it. It was Ndombele's game. He was magnificent. He's brought exactly what Tottenham needed in that team, which is fun, but he's also brought it mutually inclusive with productivity, which enables him to stay in a Jose Mourinho team, because the way he protects the ball and kind of chops it one way and moves away from a marker is exactly what Harry Kane and Heung-min Son need. And I thought Spurs were really good against a team who, you know, they couldn't counter-attack against, because, bless them, Sheffield United are not really doing anything right at the moment. And they were at fault for both of the first half goals they conceded. You know, poor marking from a set piece early on. Oliver Norwood miscontrolling it for the second goal and miscontrolling it for the third goal. And I think, it's not particularly insightful, but it was as simple as Spurs had far better players playing in far better form and were due far more than a 3-1 win.
Brilliant. Well, they've got one, and it keeps them in the mix as regards certainly the top four, and who knows, perhaps aspirations above that. After this, let's get on to Saturday's winners and losers.
RB Leipzig gift shop?
Yeah, I want to return a player. He's not working. He was supposed to help me achieve my goals, but I don't think he even knows what a goal is.
All I can say is that he was just fine working when he was to London dispatched. Lampard and Chelsea can't seem to get their money back, but you can with Paddy Power's Acca Cracker. If one leg of your 4+ fold Acca lets you down, get a free bet on all football matches and all markets. Paddy Power. Max free bet £10. Min odds 1-5 on each leg. Online exclusive. Exclude shop bets and enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply. 18+. BeGambleAware.org.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Boom. Saturday's action. And first off, West Brom, is it on? After their 3-2 derby win at Wolves, this is their first victory under Sam Allardyce, their first away win of the season. And it saw the continued emergence of a new kind of classic Big Sam player in Semir Ajayi, who's now got 3 goals in 6 games under the equally Big Sam. What did anybody make of West Brom as they roar their way out the bottom three? Not quite yet. They're 5 points off safety, but you know.
I thought it was an absolutely classic Allardyce game, in the sense that there were 5 goals. None of them came from open play. I think if Allardyce could just narrow a game down to set pieces, he would. And I think 2 came from corners, 2 from penalties and 1 from a long throw. In all seriousness, they do look better. I think that they are well organised. I think Pereira was heavily involved. Robinson was heavily involved. I actually really like the signing of Snodgrass. I know a few people were saying, oh, that's really boring, a kind of journeyman Premier League player moving to West Brom. But I think Snodgrass has got real great technical quality. I think he needs to be around players who can make runs off him. But he strikes me as the kind of player Allardyce has done a good job with throughout his career. One, in the sense he's getting on a bit. It's probably his last Premier League move. And second, he's a really good set-piece taker, really good crosser. So, yeah, I quite like that signing. And, obviously this was a huge first victory, especially in this fixture.
They've got West Ham coming up away on Tuesday. What about Wolves, meantime, whose fall-off has been truly dramatic? Obviously, part of that is the injury to their main goal threat, Raul Jimenez. This is a club, producer Charlie pointing out, who were in the last eight of the Europa League just a few months back, now on a run of one win in nine, no clean sheets in 12 in the league. They lost six of their last nine. They're lying 14th, and almost all the teams below them have games in hand on them. Crikey. Zaffod5 says, is the party over for Nuno and Wolves, averaging 0.5 points a game since Raul's injury? Relegation fight ahoy. Is it the Raul injury? Given that it's also at the other end where they're having all sorts of problems. I mean, I know that, you know, both ends of the team influence the other end, as it were, but one of their really big issues is the way that they've seemed to have totally lost their shape at the back. Is it this switching between four and three?
Maybe. I think there's very quickly, there's three things. Firstly, yes, Jimenez, and it's not just the fact that they miss his goals, it's the fact he held up the ball and brought other players into play, and that isn't happening now, which I think means they're kind of having to overload players forward to make that work, and therefore they're getting caught out a little bit. Or as Michael says, there were set pieces, goals ahoy here. They also don't have a deep squad, and they haven't since getting into the Premier League. They've had a remarkably good run, or had a remarkably good run of consistent selections until Jimenez's serious injury. And finally, I think it just shows how for every non-Big Six team, last season counts for very little. You know, we've seen that with Sheffield United to an extent. We're seeing it with Wolves, that there's just no overrun. Every year almost feels like year zero in the Premier League, because as soon as you stand still, there are clubs like Everton and Southampton and Leicester and West Ham even who buy well, get a new manager in, and suddenly they jolt above you.
I think it also shows, again, you talk about the Europa League last season, but that was August, as you said, and immediately they're into this season. So whatever you do last season, as Daniel said, if you're a smaller club, especially now, it's not just the grind of, you know, Premier League season after Premier League season. It's the peculiarities of a Premier League season, two Premier League seasons in a pandemic, when you're trying to fit everything in. And I think everything is exaggerated because of that.
Wolves, for all their disappointing run of results, still 10 points clear of the relegation battle, and better times no doubt ahead. But further down, it is looking interesting down there. West Brom, as I mentioned, now 5 points from safety. But elsewhere in the sort of bottom three picture, Sheffield United lost, Fulham lost, Burnley lost, and Brighton won. What a win for Brighton. Away at Elland Road, 1-0 over Leeds. Now, we'll touch on Graham Potter's side in a second, but just to talk about the home team here briefly. Last weekend, they had that embarrassing FA Cup defeat at League Two side Crawley. This was kind of supposed to be the reaction. What did we see?
I think one of the things with Leeds at the moment is it almost seemed like their objective was to lose by as few goals as possible. It doesn't seem to be working for them at the moment. Like, it wasn't a game where any of the things that you associate with a Bielsa side actually appeared to be happening. Especially after, as you say, after the cup game from last weekend, it just seemed like there was something. They're not scoring goals again. Another game where they haven't scored, and I think it just seemed like maybe you don't want to point yet to that sort of Bielsa cliche, but are they already getting exhausted at this stage of the season?
Be really careful when you say that, Dion. 3 weeks ago, Leeds social media encouraged a bit of a pile-on on Karen Carney when she suggested that their promotion last year owed a little bit to the season having an unscheduled three-month break in it. Since then, they've not done a very good job of proving her wrong. They've lost three games out of three without scoring a goal. Calvin Phillips' absence through suspension, no doubt influential here, but to be fair, they did look really leggy, didn't they?
They only made 13 tackles, which is a season low in the Premier League. Calvin Phillips' absence probably explains some of that, as does the fact that they generally dominate the ball, although they've pretty much done that all season, especially at home. It just seems that so much is on Bamford's shoulders, which is remarkable given at the start of the season, I don't think anyone could say with any degree of certainty that he was going to succeed in the Premier League this season. And yet within 3 or 4 months, everything is suddenly resting on him, because Pablo Hernandez was fantastic for a while, but he's aging and not really there. No one else is really stepping up other than Rafinha, who they landed an absolute bargain with him. But Rodrigo's not really hit the ground running, and so much is on Bamford. There was one chance that he kind of had an air kick, and you kind of thought, well, that might be the best chance you get in this game. And if you don't take it, then you're suddenly in a bit of trouble.
What's the story with Rafinha and Harrison playing on each other's wings? I don't have an answer for this. It's a genuine question for any Leeds fans. I thought they'd been, you know, both very bright in the last couple of months, and I didn't really get the idea of switching them. They didn't seem very productive in this game.
Mm. If it is tiredness, they do have the rare luxury of 10 days without a match, Leeds. Another unscheduled break to the season. because Wednesday's game against Southampton has been called off to allow Saints to play their postponed FA Cup third round game against Shrewsbury. Right. So Bielsa's team don't play until the 26th of January, when they'll have Newcastle United away, which, you know, could be a good fixture to come back to. Brighton, though, that's their first win in 10. And we kind of should have started by saying, well done, Brighton, who've now won more away games this season than Liverpool have. Hurrah. I mean, I don't want to call this a turning point, because I think everyone agrees they've been playing pretty well anyway, just not scoring goals. This time they scored a goal, Neil Mopé there. His fourth in 5 matches against Leeds, interestingly. But yeah, very positive, and it moves them away a little bit from the bottom three.
Yeah, and this is what they do as well. You know, in the last year, Brighton have only lost to Everton, Spurs, Man City and Leicester away from home. They've been dismal at home. In the same time, I think since Potter has been appointed, I think they've only won more home game than Norwich, and they haven't been in the Premier League for a few months. So, yeah, they've been dismal at home, but decent away. And that will, I think, will probably keep them up. Because it's a manager would consider it easier to sort out the home form, I think, than the away form. If they were losing every week away from home, you might be a little bit more worried. But that kind of intimates that there's a decent morale in the squad, and a kind of unity to fight for the cause, because they're by no means safe yet, and they've played more games than people below them. But yeah, wins like that, I just don't see Fulham and West Brom even, and Sheffield United going to Elland Road and winning. And I thought Brighton could do that, and they did. So, yeah, fine.
Do you know where their next game is, Daniel? It's at home, worryingly.
Is it?
Against Fulham. Mm. Wow.
Yeah, that worries me, because they're a slightly powder-puff team when they play at home, Brighton. They seem to let things happen to them. They don't really enforce themselves on the game, and I know that really frustrates supporters. They also need a goal scorer. I mean, I know Morpay scored at the weekend, but between him and Welbeck and Connolly, there's kind of one decent striker in there, I think, or one decent Premier League goal scorer in there between them. It's just not enough. They need a goal scorer.
Well, maybe they'll get one by the time Fulham turn up at the Amex in about 10 days' time. Now, still to come on this Totally Football show, we'll be hearing from James Horncastle about the Derby d'Italia, Juve's trip to San Siro to take on Inter Sunday night. We'll also be celebrating the end of the maximum wage in football. And we'll be discussing the other things that happened this weekend, including what Fulham did against Chelsea. And that's next.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power.
Fulham 0, Chelsea 1 Saturday tea time. Chelsea with only their second win in 7 matches. And rumours still are rumbling, apparently, over their manager Frank Lampard's position. Probably his prospects weren't helped very much by the opening periods of this game, which saw Fulham probably the better side. And then, even when they went down to 10 men, the Cottagers still hanging on for a draw until Mason Mount finally got the goal. Timo Werner continued his very, very dry spell. He hasn't scored in the league since the 7th of November. Next up, Chelsea travel to the King Power to take on Leicester. Ooh, that should be interesting, Michael.
Yeah, I think it should be. I think Leicester will start that game as strong favourites because Chelsea again weren't very good. I mean, Chelsea got the win, but I really think my opinion of Scott Parker improved further after this game, and my opinion of Frank Lampard is still pretty low because I just don't think he's really figured out a default attacking plan for this Chelsea side. I worry about his selections, and it's almost like he's picking certain players based upon, I don't know, whether they're his favourites or whether he's judging on how they behave in the dressing room or whatever. But there's certain things, like, for example, Callum Hudson-Odoi, who I must admit I was a little bit sceptical about his ability before this season, but I think has consistently done really well as a super sub. Can't really seem to get a start, and that's even without Havertz being in form and he's out of the side, Werner's out of the side. Hudson-Odoi just can't get a game, and yet he often seems like their best player. And just little things like that I find slightly confusing.
So if you were to get the nod, if, say, Chelsea were to call, Michael, what would you do? How would you set them up?
Honestly, I don't know. I think it's a really tough one. I think they've got probably at least one too many attacking players, one too many attacking player at the club. I think they've probably got at least one too many new signing at the club, and he's having to embed a lot of players at the same time. I think there's almost equal pluses and minuses to playing the 4-3-3 and the 4-2-3-1 with this group of players he's got. I think Werner's an issue because in some games you do want him as a central striker. Against a deep defence, I don't think you can use him as a central striker. So there's so many issues. I must be honest, I don't know the answer. It's Lampard's job to know the answer, and he hasn't really convinced me. And the one thing I am most confused about is, the one thing he's definitely nailed is Mason Mount's a really good player, and he knew that before he got the job. He knew that at Derby. He knew that from the first game when they lost 4-0 at Old Trafford, and Mount was probably the best player on the pitch. But what I don't understand is Mount seems to be this, like, he seems to divide opinion. A lot of fans seem to think that Mason Mount is some kind of, you know, almost hoax. Do you know what I mean? That he's not a very good player. And I just can't understand why anyone would think that, because he seems very good at almost everything. He seems super professional. He seems very, like, a nice lad. Where does the backlash against Mason Mount come from? Can anyone explain to me?
Yeah, well, this is a fairly recent thing, I think, but it might not be Chelsea fans necessarily, but I think the unfair comparison, because they're different players, with Jack Grealish probably doesn't help. That's probably the biggest stick that anyone is beating or choosing to beat Gareth Southgate with at the moment, is that kind of favour for Mount. And maybe that gets reflected in him being seen as almost like a boring player in contrast with Grealish. And I think that's highly unfair for the reasons that Michael lists. Maybe he's seen as a bit of a teacher's pet, and sometimes those kind of teacher's pet players, again, unfairly, can kind of be tarnished by that. Whereas actually it just means that a supposedly very good manager that Chelsea really want or did really want rates him, which to me is a positive, not a negative.
What do you think, Dion? Chelsea at Leicester?
I think Leicester are favourites. I thought Chelsea were poor against Fulham. I thought it was, when you saw what Lampard said before the game as well, especially because he's talked about the 2 weeks since the City game and the fact that they had a cup game in between, but they were able to kind of concentrate and work on the training ground. And he said, this has given us a chance to work on the bigger elements of our game. And then that performance, until Robinson got sent off, there didn't seem, as Michael said, there didn't seem to be, you couldn't discern what bigger elements of the game, especially in attacking form, they had been working on. So I think I would make Leicester favourites.
Leicester coming off a 2-0 victory this weekend over Saints. Brendan Rodgers unhappy at the way his team started, but a lot more content with the final score, except for the fact that once again Jamie Vardy had to come off early, hobbling a little bit. Michael?
I thought it was just a really enjoyable open game, actually, very end-to-end. I think Leicester were maybe slightly flattered by the final scoreline because Southampton has a couple of good chances. And it was just one of those games where I thought that the players you want to be having good games had good games, if that makes sense. I thought Armstrong for Southampton was very prominent in the second half. Tielemans got two absolutely lovely assists. I think Tielemans is probably still quite underrated. I mean, I think he's as good a central midfielder as you will find in the Premier League, to be honest. I think he's a brilliant passer. And also Mark Albrighton as well, who's one of those kind of players. He's just been around for quite a long time and probably doesn't get that much credit. But as I mean, he's played a really vital role in a title winning side. And yet 5 years on, when he always seemed like the kind of player who'd be phased out as Leicester brought in speedier, more dynamic players, is still going and still a lovely crosser of the ball. I mean, Leicester and Southampton, I'd say, are probably just... Are there many people who dislike those teams? Do you know what I mean? It just felt like a nice, pleasant, open game of football to watch. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, Adam Hurry described it on Twitter as the most wholesome Premier League fixture, which I think is probably true. It kind of feels like, unless you are either living in the environs or support a rival team, then they're kind of second club material for, maybe with Newcastle, I suppose, but second club material for everyone.
I mean, Saints are a very positive bunch, and then Leicester gave us the greatest fairy tale ever in football, so that's nice. You mentioned Albrighton was a big part of that title winning side. Could it be part of another, do you think, this season? Is that too much of a stretch?
Yeah, I think it is too much, unfortunately. Partly because Vardy is going to, unless they buy a striker pretty sharpish, then Vardy's going to have to play pretty much every minute of every game and score most of their goals. It's good to see James Maddison back in form, though. He's kind of struggled with injury first few months of the season, but he seems to be at it.
All right. They're third, 2 points off the top, but okay. The one game that we haven't touched too much on, meantime, was the Claret Derby Saturday afternoon between West Ham and Burnley, which, Michael, you saw and enjoyed?
1 out of 2. No, I thought it was an all right game. I thought there were two interesting things. One was the goal scored by Antonio, because it was very unusual to see Burnley concede a goal like that. You know, a cross is usually the kind of thing they gobble up. But I thought it was interesting. There was some good movement from Bowen to basically drag the entire defence out of shape. They ended up with Peters, the left back at right back. They also ended up with the centre backs the wrong way around, which maybe contributed to me making a very atypical error for him. I thought the other interesting thing was, I mean, we all know that Souček has made a really good impact as a kind of the new Marouane Fellaini, you know, as an aerial target in the opposition box for a defensive midfielder. But I thought here it was notable that his aerial prowess was really useful alongside Declan Rice against a team playing Route 1 football. It meant that they had, you know, Souček and Rice are probably, I would guess, the best aerial duo for any central midfield pairing in the Premier League. And along with Ogbonna and Dawson, who had a pretty good game at the back, they just had this square of players who were completely up for aerial challenges. And that meant that any long balls to Wood and Barnes weren't very effective. And Burnley just never got going, really.
I should mention that I'm obliged to say that Burnley are now on course to score 20 league goals this season, which is, I mean, is record echoingly bad. Derby County scored 20 in their wretched 07-08 season, and that's the lowest ever in English football top flight history. I mean, clearly at plenty of seasons that teams played 42 games, not 38, but even so, you barely find a team in the 20s. So I know Sean Dyche does some of this by design and he prefers to be resolute, but you could field six James Tarkowskis at the moment. But if you're scoring 9 goals in 17 games, you're not going to get many points. And they are very fortunate that there has been a Sheffield United this season, a club that are almost completely out of it, because otherwise they'd be in serious trouble. And they clearly, you know, they've got new owners now, and those owners might have slightly higher ambitions than this.
Right, well, they're certainly still in quite a sticky predicament. Only one place above the bottom three, but 4 points clear of Fulham in 18th. I, for one, hope they stay around a long time, because they have great names like Wooden Barnes, their striking partnership, which is fantastic, but also the ever-hilarious Ben Mee, because every time anybody mentions me in commentary, then it's just funny. Michael, you said a big mistake by me, and I'm thinking, well, what did you do? Or...
My attempts to get Ben Mee shape me any way you want me as a champ
right.
at Turf Moor.
Did that not
still falling on deaf ears.
Well, there's no crowd at the moment, but, you know,
no.
If you could have a word with the artificial, with the augmented crowd. Anyway, sorry, we'll move on, listener. Monday night, it's Arsenal-Newcastle. You're right, they did play last weekend, and yes, it wasn't particularly good. And then actually Arsenal had a really disappointing 0-0 draw Thursday against Palace, which I think a lot of people put down to Kieran Tierney's absence, because apparently if you take Tierney out of Arsenal, the whole thing kind of shuts down. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think him and Saka are the big two players. And yeah, Arsenal don't really, well, Kolasinac is left, isn't he? So they don't have a backup left back. So they don't have anyone else who can offer what he does. And he has offered a lot this year.
Well, fingers crossed that he's back. Unless you're a Newcastle fan, of course. Newcastle are also not entirely clear of danger, currently lying 15th, 7 points above the bottom three. Other games taking place midweek. As we mentioned, Leicester take on Chelsea on Tuesday and West Ham are up against West Brom. Then Wednesday, it's Fulham against Man United and hopefully Man City against Aston Villa. And next up, let's talk about some really, really big bit of history on this day.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic, this is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Listener, it's January the 18th, and it's a historic day for football because on this day, in 1961, while young folks were vibing to the sound of Perfidia by The Ventures, the maximum wage was abolished in English football. Boom. And when we say maximum wage, we mean £20 a week, £17 in the summer. Before this day, no footballer could be paid more than that. Incredible. £20 per week, by the way, back in 1961 money, is about 440 of your current day pounds, which compares quite interestingly with the figures trousered by the current highest paid players. Number one right now in wage earning in the Premier League is David De Gea, who gets £375,000 a week, so that's gone up a bit. But the man who got players a fairer deal back then by threatening an actual strike 3 days later was PFA leader Jimmy Hill, who had probably the most unique career, is that fair, that anyone has ever had in English football ever?
Yeah, I'd say he was certainly the most influential person, certainly in the second half of the 20th century. I mean, some of the things we've come to take for granted that can be related back to his influence is quite incredible. I mean, things as fundamental as 3 points for a win, the maximum wages we're talking about, electronic scoreboards, match day programmes, big screens inside a ground.
Studio pundits apparently was his invention. He was head of one of the ITV region's sports department.
Yeah, some remarkable things. And of course, he just fulfilled so many different roles as a player and a manager and a director and a presenter right. And a pundit. Yeah, just ongoing list. This kind of almost cartoon character, wasn't he? He just kind of did everything.
So, yeah, footballer, club chairman, manager, union leader, head of TV sport, match of the day presenter, match of the day pundit, and once, famously, even a linesman. Also, and perhaps most importantly, he was also, Jimmy Hill, very much go-to playground slang in my day when you wanted to express incredulity. What I think you might term chinny reckon. Yeah, chinny reckon, you'd stroke your chin. In or my just, day, you would go, Jimmy Hill. If somebody said, this guy did all that and once he was a linesman, you'd go, yeah, Jimmy Hill. But the thing is, it's absolutely true. I mean, you probably know this story, listener. We can move on. But if you don't, or if you just wanted to be reminded of the details. Famously, in 1972, Arsenal were playing Liverpool. Linesman Dennis Druitt pulled a muscle, and they didn't have a fourth official or something in those days. So they made an appeal over the PA for a qualified referee to see if anyone happened to be a qualified referee in the crowd. Naturally, Jimmy Hill was a qualified referee, amongst everything else. So he made himself known, put on a tracksuit, and ran the line. Extraordinary. The business, Michael, of him inventing 3 points for a win, how did that happen?
I'm not quite sure how that came into being, but I think I'm right in saying it was the Isthmian League, now it's the 7th division of English football. I think they trialled it for a couple of years and it proved successful, so it got adopted higher up the pyramid. But it was, you know, it was, I believe, an English thing that was gradually adopted by every other footballing nation. And, yeah, obviously, one of those things we come to accept as normal now, but there would be a few different league winners had we still been using 2 points for a win.
That's very true. Dion, were you a big fan of Jimmy Hill?
Well, I can't say. I think I was very neutral on Jimmy Hill in many ways, but I do think he's one of those great kind of restless figures in history that always get things done. And I think partly because of that, because, you know, it's almost like the, you know, the thing that, you know, your parents would say to you when you were a kid, like nobody likes a know-all. Like the fact that he could do everything, the fact that he was always thinking of different ways of things being done, meant that he also caused a bit of friction. And, you know, he was great on television. I was trying to remember, I have a vague memory from Ireland matches, from Ireland in the European Championships, or I think in the World Cup, Ireland fans singing, "Are You Watching Jimmy Hill?" And I wasn't sure. I knew he had done something to slight us, and I wasn't sure what it was. And I was just looking it up today, and it turns out, I think he said that Ireland would be making up the numbers at Euro 88, which is probably what most Irish people thought until they beat England too. But Irish people don't like... There are lots of things Irish people don't like English people to do, but one of them is to be condescending. Another is to claim Irish people as English. But on this occasion, he just seemed to be a bit condescending. And that song, as Irish supporters tend to do, it kind of hung around for years. For years, people would be, you know, crowds would be singing, "Are you watching Jimmy Hill?" And I don't think people really knew why he should be watching, but we wanted him to watch and to pay attention. But he was an extraordinary figure.
Certainly was.
He was also absolutely hated by Sunderland fans for tremendous reasons. I mean, for those who are unaware, there was a great controversy in the 1977 season when Hill was chairman of Coventry, and it was either them or Sunderland who were going to be going down. They're playing different teams on the final day, and Hill concocted a plan to delay the kickoff of Sunderland's game by 10 minutes for quite spurious reasons relating to, I think, traffic outside. That meant that Coventry could find out Sunderland's result and then they wouldn't have to go for a win they eventually didn't need. And eventually Coventry stayed up. And there's a great video from a fully 30 years later where it's a Fulham against Sunderland game and half-time there's a presentation and you know, the PA is announcing all these great legends of the club. And there's just incredible video from the Sunderland end where the PA announcer is saying... And there's the most incredible wall of booze you've ever heard. And there's also a separate video where... So this must have been a Coventry against Sunderland fan. And there's a massive statue of Jimmy Hill outside the Rico. And there's a slightly drunken Sunderland fan who just can't stop abusing this statue. He walks past it, shouts some abuse at it and walks off. And then just has to go back for some more. Actually gets led away and told to calm down by a policeman, which I'm not sure whether it's an offence or not, is it, to shout abuse at a statue? But could be topical
in the next
few months.
Government regulations suggest that, yeah, that fan would have been in a lot of trouble in the current climate. Anyway, there you go. Jimmy Hill, a man who had his good points and possibly later on perhaps one or two less positive, but certainly shaped the modern game. And on this day, finally led English players out of their exploited state. Very good. All right, well, now still to come on the Totally Show, we dial up James Horncastle for hot news from San Siro of Inter Juventus. But first, let's get some odds from Lee Price of Paddy Power.
Oh, listeners, why do I keep falling for the hype? Maybe because I've got nothing else except my beloved odds, of course, to fill my day. I've swallowed the big match build-up every single time this season. So hopefully the Premier League can make up for it with some more exciting fixtures this week. Let's see what's next. Arsenal versus Newcastle and West Ham versus West Brom. Ah, no pressure Leicester versus Chelsea then. And that game will definitely be Brendan Rodgers' audition for the Stamford Bridge gig, in his head at least. Although we at Paddy Power weirdly make Andrei Shevchenko the favourite to be the next Chelsea manager. God knows. Leicester are 2-1 to win that one. Chelsea are the 13-10 favourites. The Kanye derby sees West Ham favourites at 6-10, more weirdness, with West Brom priced at 9-2 to make it back-to-back wins. And that really would be weird. While the meeting of the goal machines sees Arsenal favourites, they're 4-11 to win. Newcastle priced at 7-1. The 0-0 is 11-1. See you soon, my darlings.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. Fun doesn't stop with Totally, listener. probably ever. Also out today, when you're done listening to this, you can hear the Totally Football League show, in which they'll be discussing Wayne Rooney, his first game as the official Derby manager against Rotherham. How did that go? By Tuesday, there'll be another host of podcasts for you to enjoy, including the Totally Scottish Football Show and the Offside Rule WSL edition, featuring talk of Chelsea against Man United, the reigning champions against the current league leaders. Michael, you went to that game.
Yeah, it was an excellent game. I mean, a really big one in the WSL. First huge test for Manchester United in their surprise title bid. And they came off second best in the end with a couple of goals from Harder and then Kirby. But I just thought the way they went about it showed a level of ambition that suggests maybe in a year's time, you know, they'll be a real force in the WSL and have a better go at winning the league. They lost, but I think they came off. In fact, both teams came off it well. It was just a very high quality, very high tempo game.
All right, more on that in the Offside Rule WSL edition. Also out on Tuesday, it's the Totally Football Show European edition with loads to discuss, including the Derby of Italy, the Derby d'Italia. And James Horncastle joins us on the line now with the final whistle having only just blown in that game in Milan. James, hello.
Hello, James.
How did it finish?
Badly for Juventus. In that they lost 2-0 and should have lost by an even greater scoreline. Antonio Conte and Arturo Vidal coming back to haunt their old club.
That's the first time that Conte has ever got even a point against Juventus, no, his former side.
Yeah, he was playing that up at the end of the game, saying that, you know, when he was coach of Arezzo in Serie B, that was the time when Juventus were down in the second division after being relegated.
Did he mention the time that he was manager of Siena?
No.
Or did he skip past that one?
He didn't mention that one either. He did say when he was coach of Atalanta as well, took a beating, and they were deserved beatings as well. But tonight it was like there was only one team on the pitch. A little bit similar to Friday's Rome derby, in that one team turned up, the other one didn't. But usually Juventus always show up in these big games. Yeah, this has been the difference between them and the pretenders to their title in the last couple of years. You think of Maurizio Sarri's Napoli and, you know, more recently Conte's Inter. And they've always just about had the edge. But tonight they were, well, not just second best, they were well below what you'd usually expect from a Juventus team in a big game like the Derby d'Italia.
Well, they've been very patchy, and of course, Andrea Pirlo in his first season as a manager of any club, but the previous trip to San Siro saw them become the first team to beat Milan with a whopping 3-1 win. They also had that resounding victory over Barcelona at the end of their Champions League group stage as well. So what went wrong tonight particularly?
Well, no, I mean, you're right to point out that there have been some highs under Pirlo. In the league, I would say they've played Pirlo ball, if you want to call it that, on a couple of occasions, executed it really well, but against poor sides like Sampdoria and Parma. The Milan game, you could again point to Davide Calabria, fullback, being in midfield, and Chiesa being able to get at Teo Hernandez and expose some of his defensive frailties. I bring up that Milan game and the midfield because I think that was the major difference tonight. Michael and I collaborated on a piece for The Athletic earlier this week, and Michael kind of quite astutely observed that, you know, Pirlo just doesn't have a player of Pirlo's profile on his team, whereas Conte does in Brozovic. And Brozovic had a good game. Was able to do things that Rodrigo Bentancur wasn't able to do in black and white, which was kind of switch the play really quickly and kind of Juventus then had to move across and they weren't able to get their timing right when they did that. But Vidal and particularly Barella was exceptional tonight. Goal and assist, but so much more. You could see he was limping at some stage, you know, but he kept going. He kept setting up chances for his teammates when they were in and around the penalty area, if we want to use that cliche, and he didn't get the ball. He was angry at his teammates for it. And Inter were rampant, really. And I think Pirlo's efforts to kind of initially mirror Conte's tactics and play a kind of 3-5-2 and then go to a 4-4-2. It just didn't really work. They never got near Brozovic. They couldn't shut him down. Chiesa was never in the game, aside from a cross in the first half. And I think one of the only shots that they had on target late in the game, he was unable to kind of take on Ashley Young and beat him. And Ronaldo was completely anonymous. And I think, you know, one of the principal issues with the ideas that Pirlo's trying to get across is he wants that team to press, regain the ball as soon as they lose it. But if you don't do it in a coordinated and collective way, you just get picked through so easily. And that's again what happened tonight.
Hilariously, Antonio Conte was saying of Juventus, some teams go out and buy stars. We make them at Inter, which, given the fact that he responds to every defeat by asking for new players, was interesting. But given the fact of just returning to this issue of Juve not having a Pirlo figure, we're in the middle of the January transfer window. Do you see them going out and buying a player of that role, or indeed any other reinforcements?
Well, I think they're looking for another striker right now, someone to back up Morata, who's been out injured. Morata again tonight. He made a cameo in the cup in midweek when Juventus had to go to extra time to put out Genoa. He's been excellent, and I think they've realised that they need someone else who can kind of take the load off. So it's not midfield where they're looking at. The only other kind of deal that they've done, but they haven't really done, is for another American player, Brian Reynolds of Dallas FC, who's a right back who's been kind of compared with Alphonso Davies. And he's going to go to Benevento with the understanding that he might join Juventus next season. So at the moment, it's difficult to foresee Juventus intervening in a kind of really decisive way that would maybe turn the title race back towards them. I mean, they've still got a game in hand, but that game in hand, James, as you well know, is against Napoli, and Napoli have been in very fine form. Well, at least they were in fine form at the weekend, absolutely hammering Fiorentina 6-0. They meet in the Super Cup in midweek. So I think this could be a really exacting week for Andrea Pirlo and Juventus. I think it's becoming harder and harder to see them winning the title this year. And I don't think that's a knee-jerk reaction from tonight. I think that's just a general feeling that's been percolating over the course of the last 6 months, really. And the Milan clubs look really on it. I mean, you're talking about reinforcements. The one club that is reinforcing in January is Milan, with I think they'll make 3 signings by the beginning of this week. So yeah, I think the Scudetto will be moving to the city of Milan come May.
As it stands, Milan and Inter both on 40 points. Milan will be playing Monday night, though, against a struggling Cagliari. So we'll see if that moves them 3 points clear again. Juve down in 5th place, 7 points off the top. James, you can tell us all about who those signings will be for Milan and how Napoli destroyed Fiorentina 6-0 and what happened to Parma under their new manager and loads of other things too in our European edition of the Totally Football Show, which will be out on Tuesday. Look forward to speaking to you for that. For now, many, many thanks.
Cheers, guys.
James Horncastle. And that pretty much wraps it up for today's Totally Football Show. Dion, anything else you'd like to leave our listener with?
Nothing, James. Just going to brush up on the rules of origin between goods between the UK and the EU, which is what I need to do now.
Belatedly. Yeah. Okay. Daniel?
No, not even that exciting for me, I'm afraid.
Just some winners and losers for Football 365 tomorrow?
Yes, indeed.
Or indeed today, as you know.
Today, yes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And Michael, big plans?
No, I've nothing to say, but I enjoyed the podcast. Thank you for having me.
All right, no, it's always a delight to have all of you on, and especially to have your ears to put it all into, listener. We'll be back with all of those shows that I mentioned, and then this one returns on Thursday. So have a great time. Until you next join us, from all of us here, it's goodbye.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on The Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.